Hello, everybody. It's time for It's All About Food. I'm your host, Karen Hartglass. One thing I like to do on this program is to promote the work of many people in the plant-based, whole foods, sustainable, cruelty-free food movement, like doctors, nutritionists, chefs, authors, activists, foodies. Last week, I mentioned the passing of Robert Goodland. I invite you to visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and read more about that great man and listen to my interview with him in the archives. Unfortunately, just a few days ago, we lost another, Rin Barry. Rin Barry specialized in the study of vegetarianism from an historical perspective. He's the author of 6 books on vegetarianism, The New Vegetarians, Famous Vegetarians, Food for the Gods, Vegetarianism and the World's Religions, Hitler, Neither Vegetarian Nor Animal Lover, and The Vegan Guide to New York City. His 6th book, Becoming Raw, he co-authored with vegan nutritionists Visanto Molina and Brenda Davis. I've had them all on this program. His many articles, as well as reviews of his books, have appeared in Ahimsa, the American Vegan Society, Vegetarian Voice, Vegetarian Journal, Satya, Yoga Journal, and in newspapers such as the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the New York Daily News, the Los Angeles Times, the Times of London, the London Sunday Telegraph, and the Washington Post. I loved reading his work, quoting him often, especially when it came to famous vegetarians in history or those who are believed to have been vegetarians. I learned from Rim, for example, that both Hitler and Einstein were not vegetarian. I met Rin over 15 years ago when I was with Earth Save International. Rin spoke at a number of my monthly dinner lectures in New York City. He was always engaging, sharing fascinating stories and historical facts. He spoke intelligently, humbly. He treated everyone with respect and never stooped to idle gossip. A few times I bumped into him at Bonobos, a raw food restaurant that unfortunately is no longer in business, and we had an opportunity to break bread, actually kale salad, together. More recently, we'd catch up at the Veggie Pride Parade in Manhattan, and I can't imagine not seeing him there this year. In memory of Rin Barry, I'm going to replay an interview I had with him in 2009 on vegetarian history. I hope you enjoy it.
How did you get started? I always like to ask all my guests how they got started.
Well, I was a teenager when I embraced a vegetarian diet, and I was being an amateur historian all my life. I was impressed by the number of famous people who had geniuses and super athletes who had gravitated to a vegetarian diet. So I decided to try it, especially when I learned of the ethical aspects of vegetarianism, when I learned that animals excrete adrenaline in anticipation of being slaughtered. I mean, plus the inspiration of famous vegetarians of the past, that actuated me to become a vegetarian.
So that's interesting. A lot of people seem to be interested in what celebrities are doing.
Yeah.
And whether it's good or bad. I mean, they don't all have the best reputation. But some of them are really impressive. And so a lot of vegetarian websites like to list celebrities that are vegetarian. And I don't know that all of them really are.
No.
But, you know, it doesn't matter if people are 100% of one thing or another. The fact is that most of the ones that are listed are near vegetarian or vegetarian for all the reasons that you mentioned.
Yes.
So let's go back in history and talk about some of the original vegetarians.
Right, yeah. Well, in antiquity in the West, the first historical vegetarian of which we have written records was Pythagoras.
Oh, I love the Pythagorean
theory. Yeah, that's right. You're being a chemist and a chemical engineer.
Right.
You would certainly know that.
So he was a smart guy.
Smart guy, yeah, as most vegetarians are. And it was actually a tenet of the Pythagorean society that one, you know, be a vegetarian in order to progress spiritually and intellectually.
Now, how long ago was that?
Well, he flourished in the 6th century B.C.
Okay.
So that was quite some time ago.
Good time ago.
You know, about 2,600 years ago.
Do we know much about it? Did people accept his premise, the idea of vegetarianism?
He was very influential, and, you know, most of the great thinkers in ancient Greece and Rome were shaped by his thinking,
okay.
You know, influenced by.
So let's move forward a little
bit. In fact, let me just add that Pythagorean was actually the term of art for a vegetarian until the mid-19th century when the neologism vegetarian was coined.
Ah, so we could call ourselves Pythagoreans? Or?
Yeah, Neo-Pythagoreans.
I like that.
Yeah,
I think I'm going to use that.
Yeah. But it had more of an ethical component to it than the word vegetarian. Because it, you know, Pythagoreanism really implies veganism, so there's an ethical dimension to it that the term vegetarian lacked.
Right, not just food related.
It's not just food. Whereas the term vegetarian has been somewhat distorted, and it's become associated with strictly dietary interests.
Yeah, well, that as a vegan, I think. I'll use whatever I can to get people interested.
Any reason is legitimate.
The environment, or we talked last week with Richard Schwartz about Genesis 1:29, how it's in the Bible. But for me, it's definitely an ethical thing too.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move a little forward in history, and who's the next one we're going to talk about? Jesus, maybe.
Well, you know, Jesus was
Jesus,
of course,
a vegetarian?
Pythagoras had his. Asian counterpart, which was the Buddha.
You know. Ah, Buddha.
And they were roughly contemporary. And
the Buddha was vegetarian.
The Buddha was definitely a vegetarian. In fact, that was the first precept of Buddhism, is ahimsa, or nonviolence to all living creatures. And his followers were required to take a vegetarian vow.
So do you know how the Buddhists kind of loosened up there? Because not all Buddhists today are vegetarian,
are they? No, that's very true. Well, scholars like Philip Kaplow put it down to Westernization, you know, the rather pernicious influence that Westernization has had on
everything.
Religions of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they used to be very, very strict in adhering to the first precept and following a vegetarian diet. But now... With the growth of the West, with the might and power of the West, people have unfortunately adopted Western eating habits, you know, as a way of emulating the success of Western culture.
Right. Do you see the Buddhists at all talking about going back to their roots, especially with global warming or anything like that?
Oh, I think it is definitely a trend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Okay, so... Now, can we talk about Jesus?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Was Jesus a vegetarian?
Well, I maintain that he was in my various books. I make a case for his being vegetarian because, you know, after all, it was difficult not to be a vegetarian in ancient Israel. And, people, the average person lived on a plant-based diet of necessity, out of economic necessity, because animal flesh was a luxury food. And Jesus, certainly emphasizing simplicity of living, would have had to be vegetarian. But also he had ethical precepts, you know, very similar to those of Buddhism, in which thou shalt not kill was really the first commandment of the Essenes, this particular sect of the Essenes to which he belonged, and. All the evidence suggests that he was a vegan. You know.
Right. And he protested with the slaughter in the temple.
Exactly. That's probably what got him killed, because he was protesting animal sacrifice in the temple. And, at that time, people would go into the temple and purchase an animal, this priest would butcher it, and then it would be roasted on the altar and... shared out among the worshippers, and so it was animal sacrifice was connected with flesh eating. So as soon as he did that, he was brought up on charges and executed. So
and the rest is history.
The rest is yeah.
Oh gosh. Okay. So who else can we talk about in history that's interesting?
Well, I think one of the most impressive figures is probably the greatest genius who ever lived. The word for whom, the man for whom the word Renaissance man was coined.
Leonardo da Vinci.
Leonardo da Vinci, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His name is synonymous with genius, you know.
Yeah.
And, he became a vegetarian as a teenager, and probably influenced by his best friend, Zoroastro, who was a vegan.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what he ate?
He ate very, very frugally. We have his accounts, you know, his the things that he bought in the groceries, and you know, simple recipes. He lived on salads and you know, fruit and not elaborate dishes.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also didn't you know, it certainly didn't diminish his strength, because he was reputed to be the strongest man in Florence, and he could
I didn't know that.
He could bend a horseshoe in his bare hands.
Mm.
Probably the only person in Italy who could do that.
Wow.
Feat,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that. Now, how about Albert Einstein? People say that he's on a lot of celebrity lists of vegetarians.
Well, he's one of those.
And he also was a super smart guy.
He was, yeah. But alas, you know, I've done the research He simply, you know, wasn't a vegetarian. The word vegetarian is never mentioned in any of his biographies.
Right.
And he suffered.
Why do you think he gets attributed?
Well,
to that?
He did. You know, a vegetarian society solicited a ringing endorsement of vegetarianism, and he certainly paid lip service to it, but without actually putting it into practice.
Mm-hmm.
But he married his second wife for her prowess in the kitchen.
And it wasn't vegetarian.
No, it wasn't vegetarian.
That's
and he
okay,
suffered
Albert.
From gastric complaints throughout
as a
his
result.
Life.
Yeah. Mm. You see?
He ate too well.
Well, I imagine for him it was tough because, you know, he was so in his head and and he needed somebody to feed him. So.
Yeah. But at least he, you know, he realized that it was the ideal lifestyle, and he certainly promoted it orally, I mean, and in writing, but not he couldn't bring himself to practice it.
Okay, now another famous person that gets noted for being vegetarian who isn't
right.
or wasn't
right, yeah.
was Hitler.
That's very true. Yeah.
And how is it that everybody claims that he was vegetarian?
Well, you know, it's a rather juicy paradox, I think, that, that people like to sort of toy with, you know, especially historians who. In fact, the world's leading authority on Hitler, Sir Ian Kershaw, stoutly maintains in his most recent biographies of Hitler that he was a vegetarian.
Really?
But
did that come out after your book?
Yeah, it did. In fact, uh-huh. The London Telegraph queried him, or the London Times actually queried him about my book, and he said, well, you know, to assert that Hitler was not a vegetarian is just utter nonsense. You know? But you know, the trouble with people like Kershaw is that. They are not vegetarians themselves, and so they don't really know what constitutes a vegetarian diet.
Yeah.
They think if you eat vegetables 5 days a week and, you know, meat the...
Or if you eat the feathered vegetable or the scaly vegetable.
Yeah, the swimming vegetable. Or in Hitler's case, it was the liver dumplings that he loved.
Oh, okay. But dumplings, they're not meat.
Yeah, right. So, you know, he admits that Hitler ate liver dumplings, had a weakness for liver dumplings,
mm-hmm.
but that's, you know, pardonable, apparently. And so one can still be a vegetarian and eat liver dumplings, according to Ian Kershaw.
Right. Okay, so much for Hitler. So, let's talk about some of the books that you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Little bit about New Vegetarians.
Yeah, that was actually my first book, and it was a collection of interviews and biographies of prominent contemporary vegetarians and people like Isaac Bashevis-Singer,
mm-hmm.
Whom I interviewed. And
you did?
Yeah, I had
wow.
the honor of interviewing him, and he was very dedicated to his vegetarianism.
That's
and,
right.
Yeah, and said that he'd wanted to be a vegetarian all his life, but. You know, his parents wouldn't let him become a vegetarian. It was only late in life that he did, but then he, you know, took to it.
Okay, who else?
There was Dennis Weaver, who's a prominent actor. Who's he was appeared in a lot of situation comedies and in dramatic series on television, mm-hmm. like Gunsmoke, which is the longest running Western.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
The adult Western, they called it. It still has, I think it still holds the record for the longest running Western, mm-hmm. adult Western. And he played a very memorable character on that program. But he told me that he never, you know, he was portrayed as a meat eater, but he always ate, you know, flesh substitutes.
Yeah, now if they did that show today, maybe they would be more apt to admitting that there was a vegetarian in that macho group.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think it's a little more realistic.
Because I find on television and in movies, mm-hmm. there's a lot more openness about, there's always a vegetarian or vegetarian comments included in the script.
That's very true.
Which is a good thing, but I think some of it is because there's a lot of vegetarians in the entertainment industry, and they're trying their darndest to get the message out however they can.
Well,
they,
you know, Hollywood celebrity personalities want to look their best, and they want to stave off the aging process. And
that's right. There's nothing better than green to do that.
Yeah.
Salads. Yeah. No calories and
Absolutely.
Lots of nutrients.
And they're usually in the vanguard of, the dietary and cosmetic trends. And so I think for that reason. I mean, Weaver, I think, was the first actor of his generation to become a, first television actor to become a vegetarian. So.
Right.
So.
Now, you say that you wrote some animal rights-related plays?
Yeah, that's right.
What were they about? I didn't know that. Is that new?
It is new, actually, and we've been performing them every summer at Summerfest. You know,
okay, give me an example of one of them and what it's about.
Well, probably the most popular one is about the life of Leonardo da Vinci, and it takes place in the palace of the Mona Lisa. You know, it was a noble woman, and she commissioned her portrait from Leonardo, and they have this dialogue about the merits and demerits of a vegetarian diet. So.
Okay. It's a two-person play?
Yeah, it's a two-person play. Well, actually, the butler makes a brief appearance.
Okay.
He actually fetches a horseshoe for Leonardo to bend, you know.
So what have the critics said about this
piece? Well, it's been very well received. We performed them at the American Vegan Society Garden Party last year.
Very
and there
good.
Are some actually some journalists present.
Okay. I'd like to read them.
Yeah, maybe we should do some on the air.
Right. There's an idea. Okay. Or maybe we could do a film version and put it on Earth Save TV. How's that?
Excellent. Yeah, why not?
Okay.
They've been performed on the air in Texas. It's Janice Blue. I don't know if you know Janice Blue.
No.
Go Vegan Texas.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And we did a couple of plays there on the air.
Yeah. Well, whatever it takes, you know, there's more and more information. There's
mm-hmm.
more books on vegetarianism and why to go vegetarian. There's certainly more and more cookbooks, which is really wonderful. And some of them are outstanding.
Yeah, that's superb, man.
And it's exciting. And they're certainly in New York City, we've got a wealth of places to eat, wonderful restaurants. But theater. We need more theater.
That's true. Yeah,
I like that idea. Okay, so you have a new book called Becoming
Raw. Yeah, it's forthcoming
Raw.
In September,
Now, I know that the co-authors, Brenda Davis and Vasanto Molina, have written Becoming Vegetarian and Becoming Vegan, so this is like
this
a third
like
in the series.
The trilogy, yeah.
Now, neither of them are raw.
No, but they're actually
are they becoming
incorporating
raw?
More raw in, okay. their, in their diet as a result of their previous book, which was called Raw Revolution, which they did with... Cherry Saria. I don't know if you know.
Right.
She
mm-hmm.
founded the Living Light Institute.
Yep. Okay. So, what's the history behind the raw foods movement?
Well, actually, it has a rather venerable history. It started in the 1830s with Sylvester Graham, of all people.
I thought it started in the Garden of Eden.
Well, yeah. That's right. I mean, but this is strictly the American version of raw foodism. You know, it does. As you say, it goes back to the Garden of
Eden
and beyond. But, the American branch of raw foodism starts in the 1830s with Sylvester Graham, and he actually prescribed a raw food diet in his lectures. And there was a cholera epidemic in the 1830s, and everyone who followed his raw food diet, survived unscathed.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And that's documented.
And he also promotes it in his book, lectures on the science of nutrition, which came out in the late 1830s.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh.
So.
Okay, and then what happened?
And then it was actually taken up by another fellow named Bernard McFadden, who was one of the great magnates, industrial magnates of the at the turn of the century, and he started a whole, chain of vegetarian restaurants and published
that were raw,
and cooked. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He himself was a raw foodist, though.
And so, when did it become really Hollywood and popular?
Well, it hasn't yet. I mean, but it's had its proponents. You know, some Hollywood people like Gaylord Houser was a kind of a raw foodist of his time, and Paul Bragg.
Oh, well, you know, Bragg's amino acids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For many, many years, he was a vegan raw foodist, but then he lapsed, unfortunately.
So what can we learn from reading the book, Becoming Raw?
I'm responsible for the historical section.
Have you read the whole piece?
I haven't read their contributions yet, but, I'm working on the final edits of my historical section. Mm-hmm. So. And their books never sell fewer than 100,000 copies. So.
Excellent.
So it's obviously going to be widely consumed.
Good. Do you know what the purpose of the book is supposed to be?
Well, it's to provide as much information, historical and nutritional, about the raw food diet as possible, because it's really a kind of virgin territory.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's just like any diet. There are different kinds of vegetarian diets. Certainly somebody could be vegetarian by living on French fries and ice cream. And then vegan, there could be a junk food vegan diet. And is there a junk food raw diet?
Well, there is a spectrum of diets, raw food diets. Mm-hmm. There's at one end of the spectrum, there's the sproutarian diet, advocated by and originated largely by Ann Wigmore and her Victoria Skolvinskas and people of that ilk.
Mm-hmm. Which I've been to her place in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's at one end of the spectrum. And then at the other end of the spectrum are the fruitarians, the frugivores, exemplified by people like Douglas Graham and Herbert Shelton, people of that sort. And then along the continuum there are embarrassed to say there are even raw carnivores. You know, they call them instinctos.
Hmm.
And they eat raw animal flesh.
Yes, I'm scrunching up my face right now.
It's really
appealing.
Quite. And everyone, complains of the stench of the, the instinctos living quarters and their kitchens. Because it's just, as you can imagine, it's revolting. But we have to point out that they do. Exist. They have
right,
a following.
Right.
You know,
raw milk and raw meat.
Raw
and
milk, raw,
fish.
Raw cheeses.
Yeah.
And raw fish, and
Okay. So, well, let's get back to the raw fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds. So there are the sproutarians, the fruitarians,
and in researching the book, I was rather astonished to discover that. Many of the sprouts are, some of them are rather toxic,
Like buckwheat sprouts.
Buckwheat sprouts, exactly. Mm-hmm. Even alfalfa sprouts have trypsin inhibitors,
So should we not be eating sprouts?
Having done the research, I would sort of caution people against
broccoli sprouts. They're supposed to be really good.
Yeah. But humans have no history until recently of consuming alfalfa sprouts, for example.
We have no history.
No.
Right. Okay.
So, of course, Brenda and Basanto are doing the definitive research on this. But
okay. I have some alfalfa seeds at home that I every now and then I sprout, and I was just looking at them this morning thinking I should finish these up. Maybe not.
But I have a good friend, I don't know if Mark Bronstein, who's written a book called Sprout Garden, and he... takes the precaution of cooking his sprouts. He cooks his...
that's interesting, because I like to sprout the larger things,
lentils
and azuki and mung. And then I just like to do a flash saute in a wok with some green onions and garlic and ginger.
Yeah.
So I don't really cook them too long, just quick.
Well, he actually cooks them as long as 10 minutes or more.
Okay.
Because of the trypsin inhibitors and other, other inhibitors that they contain.
Right. So why would somebody want to be on a raw food diet?
Well, because the nutrients are bioavailable and they don't require. One of the arguments of raw food is against eating cooked food is that the heat-sensitive vitamins and nutrients are killed by the cooking process. Anything above, say, 120 degrees is deleterious to nutrients and vitamins that are heat-sensitive. So that's the main argument for it, that we want to have as much of the nutritious, the nutritive portions of the food as possible. And heat apparently deanimates the food, and it coagulates the proteins. And
right. Well, I'm not going to tell anyone what I think is right or wrong or best or worst. It's definitely an option. I just want people to eat more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds.
Yeah.
There is, I'm a real big believer in Dr. Furman and his diet, which is a largely green diet, which is raw and steamed and juiced.
Yeah, I think that's...
And he says that when you steam the greens, some of their nutrients are more absorbable when cooked, as well as the lycopene in tomatoes when it's cooked.
Sure.
But then the argument is, do we need more? And... I'm just going to stop it there. I'm not going to give any answers. That's another show.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Unless you want to give your two cents on that.
But I think more and more people are becoming interested in the raw food diet.
We definitely need to eat a high percentage of raw food in our diet. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
And I can't say enough. We eat a lot of salads, and there's nothing like fresh, crunchy, great lettuce, and then you add a bunch of other things, and we have salad for breakfast most of the time.
Sure.
So salad's great, green, raw. You've written entries for the Oxford Companion to Food and Drink in America.
Yeah.
How did they find you?
Well,
where did you find them?
I'm also a member of the Culinary Historians of New York, they contacted me through the...
What is the Culinary Historians of New
York? Well, that's people who are, who've written books on culinary history and who belong to the society, and they have lectures. It's not, obviously not vegetarian. It's very eclectic. But they have people of all food persuasions lecturing there. And recently they had a lecture on the history of the television food program and evolution of the television chef, which is fascinating.
Like the Food Network.
Yeah, and like Julia Child and some of the early chefs.
Huh. And how has their response been to some of your information?
Rather...
Do you have an opportunity to share?
Oh, yes. They sort of kept me off the stage. When I first joined in the early 90s, actually, they were much more enthusiastic about having me speak. But recently, they've shied away from the topic, and I've been so...
Do you know Linda Long?
Yes,
she's written the cookbook.
Sure, that's
Simple
wonderful.
And Easy, I think.
Yeah, it's about she's collected vegan recipes from all the great chefs of the country, I think.
Right. Well, what she told me is all the chefs that she talked to realize the importance of including vegan items on their menus because there's more business that way. And not that everyone's vegan, but in parties now, groups of people, there might be a vegetarian or a vegan. Yeah. And if you can't go to a nice restaurant and have everybody be happy, then that's not a good thing. So they're realizing that just to please all of their customers. And so they realize the importance of it, and that's one great thing about the book. But I would think your group might realize that, at least, that they need to.
Well, I think they're feeling defensive and threatened by the...
And they should.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the early 90s, when I first joined, it wasn't so menacing, I guess. But now it's threatening to become mainstream, so they're a little more guarded.
Right. Well,
about it.
It's definitely going to be mainstream, sure, for so many reasons. One is the environment can't sustain the current diet, the American SAD, standard American meat center diet, can't sustain it. Our health can't sustain it. So more people are realizing they need to eat more fruits and vegetables.
Absolutely.
And it's just the way it's inevitable. Yeah. We know that. And so the smarter chefs will start to incorporate that, and you'll be more in demand as well.
I hope so. Yeah, I remember her saying, that some of the chefs were quite disdainful of veganism, but they, nevertheless, they provided her with interesting recipes. And they realize it's inevitable, that there's an inevitability about the movement, and you can't just ignore it.
Right. Let's go back to religion.
Yeah.
And let's touch on all of them a little bit and their history.
Yeah.
So the Muslim religion, is there some vegetarian history with them?
Well, I maintain in the book that all of even the Abrahamic religions, Judaism and its offspring, Christianity and Islam, they all have vegetarian roots, and even in Islam, there's no evidence that Muhammad ate animal flesh. I mean, in all of the biographical literature about Muhammad, there's not one instance. And it's very meticulous in their accounts of his eating habits, and never once does he consume animal flesh. And,
so where does the halal premise come
from? Well, I mean, that's kind of an interpolation. It's certainly he himself was not actually very compassionate towards animals, and he forbade, causing them misery or torturing them or hunting them.
Yeah, I don't understand in any religion how meat eating is acceptable. I just keep going back to all of their premises about compassion. It just doesn't make any sense.
I think the fathers of certainly the patriarchs of Judaism were vegans, and probably in early Christianity, Jesus and his followers, I maintain, that were vegans. The Essenes, the Ebionites, they were strict vegans, and they're trying to abolish temple sacrifice.
Trying to
abolish animal sacrifice,
Right, that was a step in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah,
could have gone a little further.
Yeah, yeah, but I think it's all been overlaid by the political.
None of the religions are really pure.
No,
either. To their foundation. So there's a lot of greed and corruption, and the
The church itself
is part of it.
Become a very corrupt institution, and it's fallen away from the early the founders of the monastic orders were all vegans, like Saint Francis and Saint Anthony. And the early monastics were all vegans.
Did any of them get persecuted because of their?
Well, yes, actually, the Franciscans were after about 100 years after Francis's demise, they started to persecute Franciscans for their humble lifestyle, because they considered them to be heretic.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Hallelujah diet?
Yes, very much so.
Do you know how that came
I actually
about?
Mentioned him in my raw food history of the U.S. because they have the founder, George Malkmus, was cancer. He was afflicted with cancer, and he claims to have cured himself through a raw food diet.
What kind of cancer did he have? Do you know?
I think it was throat cancer. I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah. Okay. So what? I'm not that familiar. I just heard a lot about the Hallelujah diet, and it sounds great, but I don't really know how it got started.
So he swears by it, and he wants to return to the injunction in Genesis to eat the herb-bearing seed. Mm-hmm. Well, Genesis 1:29, to eat what is essentially a vegan raw food diet, and he's very devoted to that message.
What kind of religion? What's his background?
I believe, well, he has his own sect now. Hallelujah, whatever that is. I think it's grown out of either baptism or Methodism. I'm not quite sure which, but.
But he's got quite a following.
Yeah, he does, and he trains ministers.
Now, is it a vegan diet?
He's trained thousands of ministers. Yeah, it's a vegan, sort of 80-20 raw food diet. In other words, 80% uncooked, 20% cooked. And
mm-hmm. Great.
He's trained thousands of raw foodist ministers, essentially mm-hmm. raw foodist ministers. Well. Some of them even have a presence in New York. There's a fellow who has a... these Malkmus Hallelujah Acres potlucks every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
They're mentioned in my Vegan Guide to New York. Actually, I have a list of all of them.
I don't have the latest. I have mine is several years old.
So. Oh, well, you can still get
you need to upgrade.
Still serviceable. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So what about, are you familiar with any of the Food Network chefs doing any vegetarian or vegan food, or if any have been approached, any of our vegan chefs, to be on any of the food shows?
Well, the woman who did the Moosewood cookbook, Molly
right.
Katzen.
Yeah.
She's done some Food Network.
Okay, she's vegetarian.
She's not a, you know, she's decidedly not a vegan, and she emphasizes that.
Yes.
She prepares eggs and dairy, and so she's an ovo-lacto.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It always has to go in small steps.
Right.
Can't hit anybody over the head.
There's
what
so many brilliant gifted chefs, in the vegan movement who aren't being given a platform yet, but I'm sure their time will come.
So what about the rest of the world in terms of vegetarianism? Are you familiar with where things are in different places? Is it moving any faster or...
Well, the majority of people in the world are vegans perforce because of the simply because they live in third world countries and they can't afford a meat based diet. People
right.
living in Somalia and Darfur they have a subsistence diet, and that's the majority of the people in the world are live on a subsistence diet, so they're vegans of necessity.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
But in countries that aspire to be first world or second world, like India and China, and, the rural Chinese, as Dr. The China study, Colin Campbell indicates, are still predominantly vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And
although that's changing, unfortunately, in China.
Yeah, it's true. But there are these vegetarian imperatives in vegan imperatives in Taoism and Buddhism that restrain them from becoming ravenous carnivores.
So is there...
And India is losing vegetarians, unfortunately.
Yes.
Which is really the sort of the cradle land of ethical vegetarianism is India. And
why is that happening?
Well, because they're emulating the success of the might and power of the West ever since they were invaded by the British. They've been...
That left a mark.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's had a very unfortunate effect on their dietary practices. And
so is there anything inspiring you can say about people that are transitioning to a vegetarian diet or... helpful words?
Well, I agree with you that it is. It's an inevitable trend. The planet simply can't sustain these meat-centered diets any longer. And I think people are becoming green. It's very fashionable to be green now. And I think the ultimate commitment to a green lifestyle is adopting a vegan diet.
Why don't most environmentalists get that?
That seems to be the last, shoe to fall or whatever. It's that they don't seem to could grasp that.
There were some young people leafleting outside, and I don't know what it was about, but a lot of times there are environmentalists out there. And when they come up to me, the first thing I say to them is, are you a vegetarian?
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of times they're not. And then I say, well, that's what you need to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the single most egregious source of pollution on the planet is the slaughterhouse and the allied industries. You know,
and it's the easiest thing. We don't have to change any laws. Yeah. Everybody can do it in their own home.
Absolutely, everyone can make the biggest contribution by simply abstaining from animal flesh. You know, and the biomass of cattle and of intensively reared animals for slaughter are contributing to the greenhouse gases, more so than any other industry. So.
Well, the greatest thing about a vegetarian, especially a vegan diet, I think, is the food. And everyone I know that's vegan is really passionate and obsessed with food. It's not that we're deprived. We're all excited about food. Yeah. So many that I know say they want to open a restaurant or write a cookbook because everybody wants to share what they've discovered. The food is fabulous. There's no question about it. And it opens the door to so many different things. Rather than grabbing a burger and fries, all of a sudden, all of these different colorful fruits and vegetables and herbs and spices and nuts and seeds, it's phenomenal. So you write this vegan guide to New York City. What a great thing. Where did you ever get the idea to do that?
Well, it started out in the early 90s as a pamphlet, you know, and at that time there were only a handful of vegetarian restaurants.
Angelica Kitchen. Candle Cafe, maybe? Caravan of Dreams.
Candle Cafe was around at that
right.
time.
Quantum Leap,
Caravan,
were they around?
Quantum, but I didn't include that in my guide because they serve fish. So.
Right.
So mine is the first totally vegetarian, exclusively vegetarian guide. We don't include restaurants that serve even a sliver of animal flesh. That means fish, you know, nothing. So it's the first exclusively vegetarian and remains the only exclusively vegetarian guide.
Right. There are a lot of guides that recommend veg friendly.
I won't name the competing guides, but there are competing guides that are several years out of date that claim to, you know, that have listings for so-called vegetarian friendly, which is a meaningless term because any restaurant.
It's not friendly.
No, it's not
friendly. They're serving other things. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also dangerous because there's cross-contamination.
That's right. I feel really comfortable eating in a restaurant that's a vegan kitchen.
Absolutely. And we have the luxury in New York of not having to compromise and of being able to dine with our friends, you know, at a gourmet vegan restaurant. And, you know, we don't have to settle for a so-called vegetarian-friendly restaurant. You know, they could take them to a Candle 79 and have the most delicious gourmet meal.
Yes, beautiful atmosphere, beautiful food. We're hoping to do our next Earth Save TV show. We'll include a spot on them because it's so phenomenal there. The desserts, everything is great there.
Or a place like Hungawi or Francia with our exotic...
Is it pronounced Francia or Francia?
I guess
I'm not sure.
It's like tomato, tomato, I guess.
Okay. I love those restaurants for so many reasons. First, it's really unusual to have vegetarian Korean.
Yeah, isn't it?
But it's not...
Or
I
vegan,
don't know.
Actually. No, they're impeccably vegan, actually.
Right, impeccably vegan. I spent... I took 5 trips to Korea back in the early 1999-2000 engineering trips and worked with Hyundai and some other companies.
Oh, wow.
And there's just one restaurant in Seoul that I dream about.
Okay.
It was all vegan, and the most expensive dish on the menu was like $13, and they would put 25 vegan dishes out in front of
fantastic.
You, all these wonderful things. But what I love about Hungawi and Francia is the food isn't very salty, because in Korea the food tends to be very salty, but really innovative, innovative stuff, and the owners are really lovely people.
Yeah, and I love that they're very absolutely dedicated to veganism.
Right.
And also the mise en scène, you know, the the atmosphere there is just superb. I mean, that tea, and it's like the Frankia is like a rural Korean tea house. You know?
Oh, we love tea. And they have so many wonderful ones. Yeah.
And it's such a serene, otherworldly atmosphere.
Yeah, that's their motto. But you walk in and you forget you're in New York City.
Exactly.
It's so
yeah.
calm.
It's a great place to meditate over a meal. You know.
So are those some of your favorites?
Well, actually, the Frankia is ranked number one in the city. In my lexicon, they're number one.
Okay. You know. What are some other favorites?
Well, we mentioned the candles. Mm-hmm. You know. I like Caravan. It's Angel, you know, the guy who runs Caravan.
Yeah. Although, Caravan has a great selection of food.
Yeah.
A great selection. It's almost like a diner.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
the food is excellent quality. Their salads are
yeah.
phenomenal.
And
I can
organic.
Always get a green juice.
Yeah, wonderful. I love that lover salad and the angel salad. Those are my two favorites.
Now, there are some new ones that have come out recently. What are the new restaurants? I know I'm not on touch.
Well, we have the first vegan ice cream parlor in the world.
Where is that?
Yeah, yeah. That's on the same street as Caravan. It's on 6th Street.
What's it called?
It's called Lula's, L-U-L-A, apostrophe S, Sweet Apothecary.
Wow, I didn't know about that.
It's a real fun.
Oh, we're going tomorrow.
You really should. It's exquisite. You know, they have two types of ice cream, nut-based and soy-based.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, Ooh. It's just extraordinary.
What else is new?
There are some other great places that, Wild Ginger has opened that's a great vegan place. They opened a second branch in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Food Swings is under new management. You know, I don't know if you've ever been there.
Yeah, I went there a long time ago.
And they've installed a bathroom, which is nice. That's what they one thing that they like.
Food Swings is great. It's not I want to eat because I'm really into really healthy.
But it's
why
unique.
Can't people that eat a lot of fried chicken and fried food and whatever eat that food? They don't, you can't tell the difference.
No, and it's the first bona fide vegan fast food place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's New York's contribution to the fast food restaurant, and it's inimitable. There's nothing like it in the country or the world. And you have to make a little trek to get there, but it's worth it, you know.
Yeah, a little out of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what else I like. Well, Blossom is also...
Yeah, everybody loves Blossom.
Pretty nice.
And two Blossoms, actually, now. Two now.
Yes. Yeah. There's one close to here that I haven't been to.
The other Blossom.
The one uptown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Manhattan is a great place for food.
Yeah. We have the greatest wealth of vegan and vegetarian restaurants of any city in the world.
Now, there's been a lot of documentaries. I'm changing the subject a little bit because I'm just getting too hungry thinking about the food. there have been a lot of documentaries coming out about vegetarianism, food.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw Meet the Truth last week, which was great. Now, there are people like Michael Moore, for example, that talks about a lot of things. When is he going to get it?
Yeah, I know.
It would do him a lot of good.
Yeah, and he would have saved himself the trouble of having to make that documentary on healthcare because, you know, that would solve all our health problems. You know.
Yeah, it would in so many ways. You know, I like to tell people that if we could reduce the preventable diseases, heart disease and adult onset diabetes and 60% of the cancers by diet, then all our research dollars could go into the things that are not preventable or things like paralysis, things through accidents, you know, that we could learn how to...
Regenerating the spinal cord.
Exactly. And it's so unfortunate that we dump so many of our research dollars into things we know how to prevent.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that money, that research money is being squandered, you know.
Yeah.
Because the answer is right before us. I mean, it's Colin Campbell with his China study, and that's unassailable research, you know, medical research, demonstrating that, the plant-based diet is our salvation, that we have to...
Now, as a historian, how did we get here? how did we get to this crazy, awful place? Do you have any
Well, my own theory is that we've, you know, the aristocracies have always adopted a carnivorous diet, and people.
We all want to be like the
rich
folks.
We all want to be to rise socially, and you know, emulate our betters, you know, our social betters, and you know, I think that's really the at the base of it, you know. And just as the you know the Asian countries, they're trying to they look up to us for guidance because we have economic hegemony, so you know they want to adopt our diet as well. They think that there's a causative relationship between diet and success, which isn't necessarily true. I mean, and
it's
taken thousands of years, but you know now certainly in the West, carnivorism has triumphed, and but it's beginning to reverse itself. You know,
do you think it'll take 1,000 years?
No. I think it's reached a critical mass, and actually, it's becoming déclassé now. You know, to eat enormous quantities of animal flesh, and the people, you know, the trendsetters, the intellectuals are adopting plant-based diets.
Are you familiar at all with Star Trek and the history of Star Trek at all?
I might have to profess ignorance on
that. Okay, I just wondered because my understanding is that they're vegetarian, the people on the Enterprise and all.
Oh, really?
And
well, it's rumored that Captain Kirk is a vegetarian for.
The actor or the character?
Both, I think.
Oh, okay. well, what I wanted to bring up is even our astronauts, when they go up, they have to eat plant-based foods because they're high in nutrition and they don't take up a lot of space.
Yeah, good point, yeah. And if they colonize other planets, they're going to be compelled to live on plant-based foods because they can't ship cattle outer space.
So it's definitely the food for the future.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and as well as the food for right now.
Yeah. And all the medical evidence is pointing in that direction. So.
Now, do you have any recipes in some of your books?
Well, I do. Actually, in my book, Famous Vegetarians, I have recipes for all of the greats. Vegetarians, past and present, you know, starting even with that Pythagoras, I reconstructed, you know, his favorite dishes from the biographical literature, you know, from references in the biographical literature. And then among contemporary vegetarians like Paul McCartney, they were kind enough to supply me with their favorite.
What was Paul McCartney's favorite?
One of them is Mrs. Mack's pea soup or something. That's something that he apparently adores.
Oh, the British like their mushy peas,
right? Yeah. So, it has recipes because people are interested in, you know. Yeah. It's still,
Do you have any desire to do a cookbook yourself? Or are you going to stick with history?
Well, you know, having become a raw foodist, my recipes are very simple now.
Right.
But I did contribute one to the forthcoming book, actually, Becoming Raw. They asked me to contribute a recipe, so I gave them a recipe for three melon salad, which was very well received. Everyone tested it and said, "Oh, this is superb!" You know.
And what is that? Three melons.
You take a watermelon.
Yes.
And you cut it into chunks. Not the whole melon, but let's say a quarter of a watermelon.
Mm-hmm.
Cut it into chunks. You take a quarter of a cantaloupe and cut that into chunks, and then a quarter of a honeydew, and then you combine the three melons into a salad, and then you make a dressing from a few chunks each of the melons, and then you add some dates and some a banana and a little citric, you know, a little lemon juice or lime juice, and then you blend it in a blender, that's forms the sauce, and then you pour that over the three melon salad, and then add nuts, pecans.
Oh, nuts too! Wow.
Yeah, so that's very satisfying.
Very nice.
Gourmet raw food.
Mm-hmm. And simple.
Yeah, very simple.
You know, I like to tell people when they're transitioning to a healthy diet that they should think about being in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
And the produce section is the only part of the supermarket to think about.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they think, a lot of people relate to the Garden of Eden. You know, mm-hmm. it has a really nice kind of euphoric, peaceful atmosphere.
Sure.
But that's really, it's easy when you think about eating simple foods. Just grab an apple and eat it. Mm-hmm. Or now I like to grab a bag of lettuce, you know, the mesquite greens or something in a bag. That's my chips.
Yeah, very good.
It's really easy to eat simply.
Yeah, green chips.
So we've been talking with Rin Barry today, and he's the author of numerous books. I highly recommend them. They're all quite interesting. I'm going to repeat them again. The New Vegetarians, Famous Vegetarians, Food for the Gods, Vegetarianism and the World's Religions, Hitler, Neither Vegetarian nor Animal Lover, and the very, very important and well-needed Vegan Guide to New York City. Where can you pick up the Vegan Guide to New York City?
Well, they sell it at most of the chain stores. Like, it's a bestseller at Borders on in Columbus Circle.
Excellent.
It's in the Barnes & Noble. All the Barnes & Nobles carry it. Even the Strand Bookstore. It's a bestseller at the Strand.
Woo!
Yeah, you can get it at a discount at the Strand.
Oh. So. Okay, well, maybe I'll get my new one there.
Yeah.
And you have a new book coming out, Becoming Raw, with co-authored with Vasanto Molina and Brenda Davis.
Yeah.
Really looking forward to that. Great. So you have some upcoming speaking engagements or somewhere where people
can hear you
talking?
I'm going to be at the Vegetarian Summerfest.
Great event outside of Pittsburgh during the summer.
Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
great.
The site of the Great Flood. Yeah.
Okay, well, where can people find out about that? Is that the NAVS website?
Yeah, that's right. North American Vegetarian Society. If you just punch in Vegetarian Summerfest 2009, then the whole program will come up.
Great. Okay.
It's a great event. So.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. This has really been fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to that 2009 interview with Rin Barry. I am so glad we have the technology to allow people's voices to be heard even after they are gone. Here's to you, Rin. We all miss you. That's the show for today. Make the most of every moment while you can, and have a delicious week.